Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we talk about on this podcast. I share ideas and strategies. I sometimes interview experts like the last podcast I just did with my good friend, Trevor Muir, who, by the way, has his own phenomenal podcast. And I share stories about what worked, what didn't work, all because I truly believe teachers play a vital role in empowering students with voice and choice. And that's what we're talking about right now, is this idea of voice and choice and empowering students. And today we're going to talk specifically about what it means to empower students to self-select the scaffolds in their learning. When I was a new teacher, I had a goal of differentiating instruction for every single student. I would provide additional directions, project sheets, tutorials, and small group instruction for any student who needed help. Now, my main focus was on providing the necessary accommodations that were in IEPs and 504 plans. If you're not from the U.S., that has to do with certain acts that relate to, you know, IDEA, which relates to students with disabilities. I kept a list of specific strategies I would use in every phase of a lesson because I wanted to make sure every student had the necessary access to those accommodations so they could truly access the learning, right? I also included language supports for ELL students, and this was, you know, doing things like sentence stems, vocabulary that was front-loaded, visuals, having things in their native language, allowing them to process and think in their native language with a partner. You get the idea. This process was sometimes overwhelmingly in a class where there would easily be 8 to 10 students who needed specific accommodations. I often had a nagging sense that some of my students who were not exceptional learners or who were not English language learners were not getting the necessary support that they needed. And so that was a huge challenge for me. At one point, I made a goal then of providing specific scaffolds for every single student based on their mastery of certain standards. But again, this became even more overwhelming. Along the way, I began to make this shift from engagement to empowerment. And this was the idea of empowering students to own every part of the learning, which is what this specific podcast series right now is all about. And it really started with the question, what am I doing for students that they could be doing for themselves? Now, initially, I focused on student choice in what they read or with what they were creating. I had things like choice menus that they were doing. Over time, I empowered students to own more of the assessment process as well. It took longer, though, for me to trust students to find their own scaffolds for learning. This shift occurred largely because of a collaboration with this amazing special education teacher named Crystal. For 2 years, I hadn't even considered what it might mean to let students self-select the scaffolds. Crystal introduced me to this idea of universal design for learning, which I'm going to get into here in a bit. And I soon realized that I didn't have to differentiate in a way that was, you know, based on every single thing that I was doing. In other words, I could provide all students with the opportunity to self-select the scaffolds that they needed. It didn't have to be just based on someone's status as a special education student or an ELL student. And when I made this shift, I found that students were more aware of their mastery, right? They knew what they knew, what they didn't know, and where to get help. And they also became less helpless in their learning. In other words, they were far less likely to be dependent on me. And as this happened, they began to grow into more confident learners. A lot of this comes down to an idea of providing just enough help. You've probably noticed that there are many things that you can do on your own, and then some things that are kind of impossible for you to do. But then there's these things in a middle zone that you can't do on your own quite yet, but you can accomplish them with just a little bit of help. That help might be from a teacher, from a parent or guardian, from a peer, but it might also be from a resource like a a book, a video, a podcast. And this is true not only for gaining new skills, but also for learning new information or for understanding new concepts. In 1962, the Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky called this space the ZPD, which was the zone of proximal development. He developed this idea as a criticism of the psychometric testing in education and the whole notion that your intelligence is permanent and fixed. He was saying, no, it's much more fluid and open. So here's how the ZPD works. You can picture it as three concentric circles. In the center, you have the things that you know on your own. That's what you can do by yourself. You don't need any kind of help. On the outside, you have things that you cannot do at all. Like, you just don't know how to do it. But in the middle, you have this ZPD, this zone of proximal development, which are the things that you can do, but they require guidance and support. The more you improve that very middle area, the more your ZPD, you can picture the circle in the middle, gets bigger, that second circle gets bigger, and the last circle of what you don't know gets smaller. And so it kind of expands outwards. So that's Vygotsky. Now I'm going to share one more theorist, and just bear with me for a moment. I know I'm getting into kind of like educational theory, which you may love and you may hate, but it's what I do sometimes. But then about 15 years later or so, Jerome Bruner applies Vygotsky's theory to the educational setting, and he comes up with the idea of scaffolding. Here, educators provide supports called scaffolds to help students master the learning. Then, like the scaffolds in a building, teachers pull back those scaffolds as students master the knowledge and the supports become kind of unnecessary. At this point, the ZPD again grows outward as students master new knowledge and then they get new scaffolds. With scaffolds, you tap into prior knowledge and you build on that knowledge with key support. These supports might be tutorials, videos, visual aids. It might involve sentence stems or front-loading vocabulary. It might be, leveled reading, graphic organizers, all of those different ideas. It could be breaking directions down into smaller tasks. But the idea is that you're providing these scaffolds for students. So we know that that's the sweet spot in learning. We know that the ZPD is a big deal, and we want students to move along that zone of proximal development. But again, like I mentioned before, it is overwhelming to try to do all of these things on your own. In my book, Empower, that I co-wrote with AJ Giuliani, I mentioned this idea of ice cream shops as a metaphor for differentiated instruction. So if we think about scaffolds, that's the whole idea of differentiating your instruction for multiple learners. So here's kind of how it works. The first one is Baskin-Robbins. It's 31 flavors. The rotation changes each month, so maybe there's more, but you get the idea. What you're doing is you're providing those scaffolds for 31 different students. It's a lot for you to do. You're in charge of it, and you get them what they need. The second layer, though, is this idea of Cold Stone Creamery. And Cold Stone Creamery is where you are tailor-making the scaffolds exactly for every single student. So you can kind of think of the Baskin-Robbins approach as maybe pulling a small group who all needs help with this, or leveling your groups. If you think about reading groups that are on multiple levels, that's the Baskin-Robbins approach. Cold Stone approach is I'm going to personalize it for every single student. So each student gets a different thing, right? And what that's going to mean is I'm basically designing all of the scaffolds for every single student. It's fully personalized. While this works, the challenge that you run into is that it's overwhelming. There's more choice and agency, there's more engagement, but it becomes exhausting to try to tailor design these scaffolds to all of the students. But when they get to own the process, they shift to the Froyo model. Here they decide what they want to learn by doing more of it themselves. There might be fewer choices in some cases, but there's more autonomy. If you think about a frozen yogurt place, you go in there, you decide how much yogurt you have. You decide which toppings you use. You own more of the process. And so I bring this up because the goal in thinking about these models of differentiation is to shift toward empowering students. And when they have that frozen yogurt model, right, where they get to decide, again, how much yogurt's being used, which ones they want to combine, what toppings they want to use, you're moving along this continuum from, you know, a student agency from teacher-directed on one side to more student-directed on the other side. You can think about it as compliance would be fully teacher-directed. I'm doing this because I have to. Engagement is more of a I'm doing this because I'm into it, I enjoy it, but it's still very much directed by the teacher to a place of empowerment. I'm doing this out of a sense of ownership in the process. And so in thinking about this frozen yogurt model, I think when we think about empowerment, the same thing is true of those scaffolds. We want to have them take that froyo model and really own the entire process. And this requires us to take a universal design approach. Years ago when I taught middle school, I worked with this special education teacher. I mentioned her before. Her name's Crystal. And she transformed the way I thought about scaffolds. One of her chief goals was that there would be no visible distinction in class between learners with exceptionality, that's the special education students, and the rest of the classroom. Similarly, she wanted co-teaching to mean that we both did direct instruction, we both pulled small groups. You know, the idea of co-teaching is that we were equal teachers. And she put it this way, inclusion means full inclusion. There should be no distinction visibly when you go into class between who's special ed and who's not. Now, my initial response was a bit of skepticism. I remember saying to her, what if a student uses a scaffold that they don't need? What if general education students use an accommodation that's meant for a special education student? And I was worried about it from, honestly, kind of an equity standpoint. You know, like it felt almost unfair to students who needed it that someone who didn't need it would be using that accommodation. But her response was simple. She said, SPED is a service, not a student. We teach students, we provide services. She then asked me if I used a curb cut or a ramp on the sidewalk. I wasn't sure what a curb cut was, but she kind of explained it to me. And I said, yeah, they come in handy when I push a stroller. Now, my kids were really little at the time. They're much, much older now. And then she said, John, have you ever watched TV with closed captioning on? I nodded. That's universal design, she said. Now, if you're not familiar with universal design, it's the idea that what you've designed for one person who might need it could then be available to anybody who would want it. I'll give you some background on it right now. It's the idea that came from Selwyn Goldsmith, who designed the initial curb cuts or drop cuts to allow people with limited mobility to access city sidewalks. And it was part of a larger movement led by disability advocates toward universal design in the built environment. And it was all about changing policies, systems, and structures to promote, again, full inclusion, which is exactly what Crystal was describing to me. In the last few decades, architects, product designers, UX designers, all of these different people have embraced this philosophy called universal design. Ronald Mace was the one who coined that term, universal design, and he was a disability advocate, a designer, and he himself was part of that community as well. But I remember, in reading his work, what he said was, the core idea is that we should design environments to be usable by all people, quote, without the need for adaptation or specialized design. In other words, you're designing for everyone. This inclusive approach allows everyone to benefit from such designs. So, you know, someone pushing a stroller benefits from curb cuts. Viewers using closed captioning, again on the videos, they can still access it even if they're not hearing impaired. In other words, when you design for everyone, everyone benefits from the design. Now, universal design for learning takes these same core ideas, the same philosophy, and it applies it to learning, from learning space design to materials to instruction to assessment to classroom culture, behavior management. It's the idea that we should design in a way that everyone can be fully inclusive. Built around cognitive neuroscience, UDL is an inclusive educational framework that seeks to remove barriers while also keeping the learning challenging for all students. This is kind of a paradigm shift from a deficit mindset to promoting neurodiversity, from singular accommodations for key students to universal accessibility to the scaffolds and supports for all students, from a teacher-centric view to a more student-centric view centered on student agency. If you want to learn more about Universal Design for Learning, there's a sketch video that connects to the article connects to this particular podcast. So if you go to spencerauthor.com, if you find the article, I do have a sketch video. And if you ever want to use that to share with others, please feel free to use that sketch video as well. Now, I want to point out that this self-selection process isn't always automatic for students. You might need to work with certain students on accessing scaffolds or on self-advocating. Often this works well when there's a partnership between a general education teacher and a special education teacher. Earlier, I mentioned Crystal, who would meet with students to help them set goals, identify strategies, design systems, and all of that was her teaching them how to self-select the scaffolds. As the year progressed, though, students in her caseload would take more and more ownership of the process until the point where she was merely observing and answering questions only when it was necessary. So her goal was that they would become self-directed as learners. So that's the big idea. Now, what does this actually look like? I want to explore a few practical ideas now. I think the best approach is that you need to have a partnership between general education teachers and then ELL teachers and special education teachers. When all the teachers are working together, it becomes much easier to come up with a design and a plan for students to self-select the scaffolds. But here are a few different ideas of what this might look like. Number one, provide tutorials for all students. This could be a curation of video tutorials. There could be step-by-step directions with like embedded GIFs or GIFs that you use. Many of these tutorials tend to be academic, but you can also have tutorials for technology or for classroom processes or for best practices in other areas like how to do video editing or podcast creation. The idea is for all students to have access to these tutorials at all times and for it to be easy for them to access. Idea number two is to incorporate anchor charts, visuals, and graphic organizers that all students can access at any time. We can provide calendars and checklists, project blueprints, those types of things that break down the tasks for students. Similarly, you might provide slideshows ahead of time. It's a common, that's a really common accommodation for students who need some support in executive function, for some students who are ADD, for some students who are dyslexic. But by having these slideshows a day or two in advance, when possible, any student who wants to know that information and wrestle with it ahead of time and kind of know where you're going, they can have that same access. And what you're really doing is you're breaking down the information and making it easier to go from working memory to long-term memory. And that helps students, again, who are struggling with executive function to build up that function, that long-term memory, and really to move the initial cognitive load so that it's not quite so heavy, right? You can think about cognitive load as how much the mind is processing at any one time, and you're breaking it down with graphic organizers, checklists, things like that, chances to talk to each other, you know, providing moments where they can talk to each other. All of those things allow students who need that additional time to be able to have that additional time. Number three, make small groups optional. There's a phenomenal expert on PBL and SEL both named Mike Cackley, and he introduced me to this idea years ago. Instead of pulling groups based on a label like ELL or special education, he reteaches key concepts by running optional workshops each day. So every student has access to these workshops and can attend them each day during their project time. This helps prevent the stigma attached to a special education label, right? And to needing to go to a small group, while also sending the message that it's okay to need help, that we're all going to own it when we need help, and that we're gonna go get the help that we need. Along the way, they develop more of that growth mindset as they move toward mastery. Idea number four is to provide learners multiple methods for accessing the learning content. This includes multiple font sizes, closed captioning, text-to-speak technology, the ability to change the speed in the audio and the video. And what that does is you're basically providing the tools that you would give for, you know, maybe someone who's visually impaired, in some cases for someone who needs a slower speed to access the language, like an ELL student. And you're saying anyone who needs that can have access to that. Number five, provide flexibility with timing. I recently wrote about this idea of my concern with the notion of learning loss, which has been, you know, a big topic. And I think we're focusing way too much time and attention on this idea of learning loss. And students are internalizing the notion that learning is just, it's all about speed and accuracy. So what we can do is we can be flexible with our timing so that students can work at different paces, and that makes differentiation more of a reality. This might include having flexible due dates, which I know can be tough and hard to manage, but I'm telling you, it really works out well. It can also mean having additional think time, having more chances for students to do something like a think pair share, to have some retrieval practice during a lesson. Idea number six is to front load the vocabulary ahead of time so that all students have access to the shared language of the content. And then you can have a bank of all of your vocabulary words online so that students can access that language. It could be, again, online, but it could also be having anchor charts that they can go to in the physical classroom and just flip through the anchor charts to find, you know, what they need. Idea number seven is provide sentence frames that students can access at any time. If you're not familiar with sentence frames, they're this idea of having part of a sentence and then having kind of a fill-in-the-blank area. For example, a sentence frame might be, one difference I noticed about blank is blank. Or, what happens if blank, question mark, and that's more of a sentence frame for a question. You can do it for whole paragraphs. You can do sentence frames that are like designed for discussions where, you know, partner A and partner B can both use the sentence frame and engage in meaningful academic discourse. But this is designed for students who are learning the language for the first time. So it's typically treated as an ELL strategy. But I found that any student who's struggling with complex or academic language can benefit from self-selecting sentence frames that they can use. So ultimately, as educators, we want students to learn how to become self-directed, lifelong learners. We won't always be available for students in every facet of their lives. So when they learn how to self-select the scaffolds, they learn how to find help on their own. They internalize the idea that getting help is a good thing, and they're less likely to give up. They don't need to be helpless and wait for the grown-up to provide the supports. In the process, they learn how to determine what they know, what they don't know, and where to find the strategies to access new learning. In other words, they become more empowered as thinkers and learners and people by the students. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? Would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Also, would you consider telling a friend about this podcast? Word of mouth is still one of the best ways to share it. So again, if you enjoy this podcast, would you just consider doing those things? I would appreciate that. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.